Chapter 2. 3 o'clock in the morning, the streets were almost completely deserted. There had been a time, once, when New York City never slept, thought Steele, but that had been before the war, before some crazy bunch of Islamic fundamentalist fanatics somehow got a hold of a substance that some brain-damaged genetic engineer had brewed up for no better reason than he thought it could be done, and they were paying him to do it. It wiped out over 3/4 of the human race. Steele wondered what it must have been like. He hadn't been alive then. He had been born into the new world, the world of the survivors, the world of those who scratched and clawed among the ruins of the previous civilization, refusing to admit that anything had really changed. Just one more man-made disaster. We'll get by. This too shall pass. And pass it did, but not without leaving behind a lasting legacy. Or at least, a legacy that would last until human society managed to struggle back to its feet once more, shake off the dust, and start building a new civilization that, with any luck, wouldn't fuck things up so badly. Steele tried to imagine what the city had been like back then. People dying, bodies dropping everywhere you looked until the virus started to go through its series of mutations, some of which killed quickly, others slowly. Death descending from the sky as bombs fell, each superpower blaming the other and trying to get its licks in before the end came. Fortunately, they hadn't launched them all. The virus got in through the air ducts before the launch control centers sealed up, and missileers died with their fingers poised above the deadly buttons. The dust settled, and the virus with it. And the world was left a very different place. The civilized core of New York City, now known to the residents simply as Midtown, had escaped unscathed except for the devastation that the virus wrought. All around it was a no-man's land, a lawless urban jungle where well-armed street gangs controlled the turf and the economy with greedy eyes on Midtown, where the wealthy people lived, the people with the jobs and the police, the people who were mostly white. Steele had spent much of his adult life in what could only be described as border warfare, assigned to the police commando unit known as Strike Force, trying to keep the crazies out in no-man's land from overrunning Midtown. He'd engaged in seemingly endless urban guerrilla warfare with the gangs, doing his part to keep their population down. He'd hunted screamers, the mindlessly psychotic victims of the mutation known as Virus 3, who needed to be shot on sight before they could spread the disease to others. He'd fought against the organized crime families who had gone truly big time in the war's aftermath, with powerful, heavily armored enclaves on Long Island from which they relentlessly kept trying to extend their influence into the city. In its own way, his life had seemed very simple then. The lines had been clearly drawn, the borders well-defined. No longer. He was still a Strike Force cop, in a manner of speaking. He still had his police commission, but he was now officially assigned to Project Steele, which consisted of himself, the nation's only cyborg, Oliver Higgins, Jennifer Stone, Dev Cooper, and a staff of agents and technicians working under the aegis of the CIA, an organization that was itself suffering from something of an identity crisis. Higgins' official title was deputy director, and he was head of both Project Download and Project Steele, at least for the time being. It was, Steele knew, only a matter of time before the agency's chief nemesis, Senator Bryce Carman, lowered the boom. He believed that the agency had outlived its usefulness and was no longer necessary, a needless expenditure in these trying times. He had a point. The traditional role of the CIA had become meaningless in the war's aftermath. The nations of the world were too busy with their own internal problems, just trying to survive, to worry about conducting any sort of meaningful foreign policy. The once massive agency had been steadily whittled down over the years until it now consisted of only a handful of personnel, occupying only one floor of the federal building and the lab complexes beneath it. The agency director was Carmen's servile flunky, trying to brown nose his way into another cushy government position when Carmen finally brought the axe down. And Higgins constantly had to battle for what little budget the Ways and Means Commission was willing to allot him. Project Steele was currently in stasis. The idea of constructing cyborgs for assignment to urban police departments throughout the country had died when Mick Taylor, the second cyborg in the first of the new Stalker series, had malfunctioned and gone on a killing rampage. That had almost finished the agency completely. The legislature had rammed through Carmen's bill, outlawing the construction of any more cyborgs, and Carmen had intended to take Download away from Higgins and relocate it to Los Alamos. and that would have eliminated the agency's sole remaining reason for existence. The only thing that stopped him was the aborted military coup by General Zachary Cord, who had attempted to seize control of the government through nuclear blackmail. If not for Steele, he would have succeeded. As a result, Steele had become a hero, and Carmen had reluctantly backed off. But he hadn't given up. The public memory was short. A few more months, perhaps another year at most, and Carmen would take control of Download, close down Project Steele, and that would be the end of it. Steele wasn't really worried. It wasn't as if they would dismantle him. Even Carmen wouldn't go that far. No, he'd simply be left without a home. He'd lose his luxurious government-issue penthouse, and if he got damaged, there'd be no more rebuilds. He'd probably go back to Strikeforce and become a simple cop again. Well, maybe not a simple cop. Things would never be simple again. As he walked the deserted streets, his mind was in a turmoil. He wasn't really paying attention to where he was going. It didn't matter. He just needed to get out into the streets, into the night, into his element. Had he imagined that phone call? No, he couldn't have. Raven had heard it, too. At least, she had heard the phone ring, but she hadn't heard that voice on the phone. His own voice. Clearly, he had imagined that. Some sort of auditory hallucination. It had to have been somebody else on the phone. It couldn't have been himself. If he had answered it, he couldn't have made the call. He kept wondering if he was going crazy. There had to be some sort of logical explanation for what had happened, or what had seemed to happen. The phone had rung, that much was a certainty. He had picked it up. Someone had said, "We need to talk." All right, it could have been anybody. No, it couldn't have been just anybody. That statement presupposed a familiarity, as did the remark, "Don't you recognize my voice?" It could have been Higgins, or Cooper, maybe. Someone who had access to his private line. Someone who might call him at such a late hour. He must have simply imagined that it had sounded like his own voice. Some sort of weird loop, perhaps. A minor malfunction in his auditory system. A malfunction. Jesus, was he breaking down? He'd heard it. He knew he'd heard it. It has been his own voice, without question. He had received a phone call from himself. And that was crazy. A police cruiser pulled up next to him as he walked aimlessly down the street.
"Hold it right there."
The searchlight was turned on him.
"Oh, it's you, Lieutenant,"
said the officer behind the wheel. Steele didn't know the man. The cop in the cruiser wasn't a strike force officer, but regular corps, Midtown police. His partner sat beside him in the armored cruiser.
"Everything all right, sir?"
"Yeah, everything's just fine," said Steele. Sure it was, he thought. "I'm just having some kind of electronic nervous breakdown."
"Give you a lift somewhere?"
"No, thanks. I was just feeling a little restless. Came out for a walk."
"Okay, Lieutenant. We'll be cruising back around here in about another 20 minutes in case you change your mind or need a ride or anything. We'd be happy to oblige."
"Thanks. Appreciate it," Steele said. "Take it slow."
"You too, sir. Night."
"Good night." The cruiser pulled away. Steele looked around. He'd walked much further than he thought. He was on 6th Avenue, once a part of No Man's Land before the city won back a few precious blocks from the gangs. He stood near the corner of Waverly, a couple blocks from Washington Square. For no particular reason, he started heading toward the square. He turned south on McDougal. There were still some places open at this time of night. Most of the bars and clubs in Midtown closed at 2, but some remained open until 4. And for the real diehards, there were private clubs that stayed open until dawn. A lot of the night people liked frequenting the areas near Midtown's borders. It gave them a feeling of adventure, a sense of living dangerously. Most of the bars and clubs in this area were on the trendy downscale side. It was possible to rub elbows with gang members who strayed across the border, usually to sell some drugs or ordnance, or perhaps pick up a hooker, some girl from no man's land who sold herself to keep her kids fed, or to maintain her drug habit. Steele knew the area, but he had never frequented any of the clubs or bars here. Cops preferred to do their drinking with other cops, and the Strike Force did their drinking at Mulvaney's, a small and unpretentious place across the street from headquarters. There weren't many people on the street. The area was well patrolled, but these days one couldn't be too careful. One of the city's few running subway lines operated just a block or so away, but most of the night people did their traveling to the clubs by cab or limo. And despite the fact that most citizens of Midtown went armed, hardly anyone went out alone. If you didn't have a bunch of friends to go out and socialize with you, you stayed at home, assuming you were smart. Not everybody was. Steele had a sudden urge to go into a bar and have a drink, just to hear the sound of voices, voices that were not his own. He was on edge. Maybe the smart thing to do would be to call Dev Cooper. It was late, but Cooper would understand. He'd probably be glad to get the call. Steele knew it was incredibly frustrating for him. He had come all the way from Santa Fe for what he must have figured would be the opportunity of a lifetime, only to wind up with a patient who resented shrinks and didn't feel like talking to him. Steele couldn't help it. He knew Dev Cooper meant well, and he wasn't a bad guy. Under other circumstances, it might have been different, but no other circumstances were possible. With Liam, it was different. Liam was a priest. More importantly, Liam was also his friend. Anything he said to Liam Casey went no further. But Cooper's job was to maintain the records of everything Steele said and did. Cooper was one of them. And Cooper had the shrink's disease. He could never stop analyzing. He could never stop prying and reading into things. Maybe he was well-intentioned, but the bottom line was that Dev Cooper simply could not be trusted. Which left only Liam, and Steele couldn't talk to Liam now. What would he say to him? I'm losing my mind, Liam. I'm getting phone calls from myself. I'm obsessed with another man's wife, a woman I've never even met or seen. I keep remembering things that I've never done. Voices from other people's past keep haunting me, and they simply won't let go. And I'm afraid. Afraid that I may snap like Mick did and start hurting people. Afraid that I may go insane and start to kill. What could Liam do? Commiserate? Pray for him? What the hell good would that do? Did God care about machines? Why unload on Liam and burden him with his troubles when there's nothing he could do to help? Steele stopped suddenly, feeling faintly puzzled. At first, he wasn't quite sure what it was. He was standing on the sidewalk by a short flight of steps leading down to the entrance of a bar. There was something vaguely familiar about it. The sign over the door said Rick's Cafe. He went down the steps and through the door. There weren't many people in the bar. It was coming up on closing time, and the place was almost empty. The floor was old and stained, and the walls were bare brick, with lumps of mortar sticking through the cracks. The place was dimly lit, and there were candles stuck in bottles on the tables in the booths. The tables were covered with red and white checkered cloths. There were framed reproductions of old movie posters on the walls. In a daze, he moved toward a corner booth in the back. Above the table hung a poster of Humphrey Bogart cheek to cheek with Ingrid Bergman, with the title Casablanca printed in red script underneath. A Warner Brothers First National Films Inc. release with Paul Henry, Claude Rains, and Sidney Greenstreet, directed by Michael Curtis. Steele felt a knot forming in his stomach. He felt as if he had been here before, and that he knew that he had never been here. Jonathan had. This was the place from his dream, the place where Jonathan and Donna had seen each other for the last time. The booth was empty, but he could almost see her sitting there, looking up at him with tears in her eyes.
The kitchen's closed,
said a voice at his elbow.
We'll be having last call pretty soon, and say, I know you. Aren't you Donovan Steele, the cyborg?
Steele turned to look at the young waitress. She was perhaps in her mid to late 20s, cute-looking, with long blonde hair, worn in a ponytail, a sleeveless white cotton blouse, a short black leather miniskirt, and black stockings with high heels. The heels couldn't have been very comfortable for being on her feet all night, taking orders, but it made her legs look good, and they were probably a job requirement.
Yeah, I'm Steele.
I knew it was you. I recognize you from TV. Wow, I can't believe I'm actually standing here talking to you.
Well, don't make a big deal of it, okay?
Said Steele.
I just came in for a quiet drink. I think I'll take this booth.
Sure thing,
she said, the unruffled New York cool asserting itself.
What can I bring you, Mr. Steele?
Scotch. Neat, said Steele.
Coming right up.
She hurried back to the bar. Steele sat down in the booth, looking around the place. It all seemed so incredibly familiar. The table over there, that was where Jonathan, had proposed to Donna. And this was where it ended for them. Or at least, this is where he left her. Like with him and Janice, the relationship had ended long before Jonathan had left. The bartender brought the drink over himself.
Here's your drink, Mr. Steele,
he said.
On the house.
Oh, no. I'll pay for it.
Your money's no good here, sir. It's an honor having you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
My pleasure. I'm Rick. I run the place. Anything else I can get for you? Something from the kitchen.
I thought it was closed.
Not for you. It's no trouble, believe me. Would you like a menu?
No thanks. I'm not really very hungry. But maybe there is something you could do.
Name it.
I'm looking for someone who
used to come here. We get a lot of people in here. I don't know. You got a photograph?
No, I'm afraid not. You have a pencil and paper?
Sure, just a minute.
Rick came back a moment later with a pencil and some paper. Steele took it and started to quickly draw of Donna from memory. He had never done any drawing before. He had never possessed any talent for it. But the drawing came out like a computer graphic illustration, looking as detailed as a photograph.
Hey, you're pretty good,
the man said.
You ever seen her?
Steele asked.
Her name's Donna. I'm afraid I haven't got a last name.
The man took the drawing and stared at it.
Yeah, come to think of it, I have seen her around. It's been a while, though.
Steele tensed.
You remember her last name?
No, I can't say that I do. A lot of people come in here. Regulars, you know. Often you don't know their last names. Just the first.
She might have been with a man named Jonathan.
Yeah, that's right. I remember.
Please, sit down, said Steele. Anything you can tell me. It's important.
What's she done?
Asked Rick, sitting down across from him.
As far as I know, nothing, Steele said. This isn't official. It's, sort of personal.
Oh, I see. Well, reason I remember is there was this one night about a couple of years ago, I guess it was. She was in here with this guy, Jonathan. I didn't know him, but I remember his name because you just mentioned it and she called it out. Kept calling it out, you know. Jonathan, come back. I love you. Like that. Guy walked out on her. Got up and left, walked out without even looking back. It was pretty sad. The whole place heard it. She just fell apart.
The bartender glanced down at the picture Steele had drawn and kept looking at it.
She didn't get hysterical or nothing, but after he left, she just sort of sat there, numb-like, staring with this glazed look in her eyes, crying. Not sobbing or anything like that, but just sit there very quiet and still, with tears streaming down her face. I think everybody in the place felt bad for her, but nobody said anything. I mean, what was there to say, you know? It was sort of awkward. People get dumped. It happens all the time. It's happened in here more than once, but this wasn't your usual sort of scene. There wasn't any screaming or throwing drinks or anything like that. She just sat there like she was in shock or something, crying quietly. Matter of fact, now that I think about it, she was sitting right there in this very booth where I'm sitting.
Go on,
said Steele anxiously.
One of the waitresses went over to her,
Rick continued. He frowned.
Julia, I think, or maybe it was Kathy, asked her if there was anything she could do, like call a cab or something. She didn't say a word. It was like she hadn't heard. She just kept sitting there, staring with this blank look on her face, crying. Julie. Yeah, it was Julie. Came back over to the bar and just shrugged, you know. What can you do? So I poured a stiff drink and took it over to her. Set it down in front of her. For a second, she didn't even react. Then she looked down at her drink, stared at it for a moment, picked it up and tossed it back. Looked up at me, took a deep breath, and thanked me and asked if she could have another. What was I going to do, say no? I got her another one. She drained that too. She kept going. I don't remember exactly how much she drank, but it was a lot. Funny thing,
said Rick, thinking back.
She got drunk. I don't mean that's funny. I mean, she got really plastered, you could tell. But your neck messy, and, you know, time she left here, she could barely walk, but she kept quiet and dignified, like, walked out of here with her head up, like she was proud and had nothing to be ashamed of. Almost fell flat on her ass going out the door. But she didn't want help from nobody. Lady had style. Gotta give her that.
And was that the last time that you saw her?
Oh, no,
said Rick.
She kept coming in. Every night at first, she'd come in and sit right here in this same booth. If the booth was busy, she'd wait at the bar till it was free, and then she'd just sit here real quiet, not talking to anybody, and get shit-faced, but she was always the same. She'd get completely wrecked. But she wasn't a sloppy drunk. She'd just sit here and get quietly bombed, staring at nothing. And then she'd say goodbye and stagger out. After a while, she started to come in less often, a couple times a week maybe. Then only once a week. Then just every now and then.
How long has it been since you've seen her?
I don't know, a few weeks, a month, something like that. I figure she found herself a bottle and crawled into it. Or maybe she found herself another guy, somebody who treated her better. I kind of hope so. I hate to think of a lady like that going down the tubes.
Thank you, Steele said. You've been very helpful. Would you do me a favor and give me a call if you happen to see her again?
Sure thing.
Steele wrote down his number and handed it to them.
Listen, do you mind if I keep this?
Rick said, holding up the picture Steele had drawn.
No, not at all. In fact, maybe you could show it around in here and ask if anyone happens to know who she is.
No problem. You mind signing it?
Signing it?
Said Steele. Rick looked a little sheepish.
Yeah, you know, like an autograph. Thought maybe I'd frame it and hang it on the wall. So people know you'd been here. That is, if you don't mind.
No, of course not,
Steele said.
Could you sign it to Rick?
Steele took the sketch and signed, "To my buddy Rick, thanks for everything, Donovan Steele."
Hey, that's great,
said Rick.
Thanks a lot.
Anytime, said Steele.
Listen, I'll ask around, see what I can come up with for you.
I'd appreciate that,
said Steele.
My pleasure,
Rick said.
Listen, come back anytime, okay? On me. It's a privilege having you here.
Thanks,
said Steele, embarrassed.
That's very nice of you, but it's not really necessary.
What, are you kidding? After all you've done for this city, it's the least I can do to show my appreciation. It wouldn't hurt my business any, knowing you are here, but look, don't get the wrong idea. It ain't just that you're a celebrity. You got a lot of respect in this town, Mr. Steele.
My friends just call me Steele, okay?
Yeah, okay, Steele,
Rick said with a smile. He offered his hand and they shook.
It's been an honor meeting you.
Pleasure meeting you too, Rick.
Rick held up the sketch.
I'll see what I can do.
Thanks.
Rick left. As Steele got ready to leave, the cute young waitress came back to his table.
We're about to close. Anything else I can get you?
No, thanks. I'll be leaving.
You in any hurry?
Sorry?
It'll only take me a little while to check out after we close up. I thought maybe you'd like some company. I only live about a block away.
Steele smiled.
I'm flattered, he said, but I'm involved with someone.
Lucky girl.
I'm not too sure about that,
Steele said.
Oh?
Never mind.
He took out his wallet to leave her a tip. She put her hand on it.
Put that away,
she said.
No, really, I'd like to.
Forget it. Just do me a favor.
What's that?
If you ever get uninvolved, come back and look me up.
If I do, I might just take you up on that.
She touched his chest.
Please do.
What do you mean you can't talk to him now?
His phone's out,
Cooper said wearily.
What do you mean it's out?
I mean it's out. It doesn't work.
Hell, you better get over there.
As a matter of fact, I was just about to do that. I was getting dressed. Does this concern what I think it does?
I just had a call from the Matrix.
You too, huh?
Listen, we've got an awkward situation here,
said Higgins.
I know. I'm familiar with it.
There was a brief silence on the line.
What do you mean by that?
Cooper sighed.
I know about the tape.
Silence.
You saw it?
Higgins said after a moment. Cooper reached for his cigarettes. He cleared his throat.
Caught a brief glimpse.
Great,
said Higgins. Cooper could hear the grimace in his voice.
I trust you found it entertaining.
It's not really my sort of entertainment. I'm sorry to cause you any embarrassment, Higgins. I don't exactly go out of my way to watch it. You don't need to be concerned about my discretion. I should hope that would go without saying.
Yeah, well, it isn't really you I'm worried about,
said Higgins.
The Matrix threatened to put it on TV, on the evening news, unless I told Steele all about it.
Oh, I see.
Can it actually do that?
I'm afraid it can. It seems to have some fairly astonishing capabilities. I put the tape up on my TV here in the apartment. I didn't really see that much past the initial glimpse.
But you saw enough.
Yes, I suppose so.
Hell!
Look, I know this is a somewhat uncomfortable situation,
Cooper said.
But you and Jennifer
didn't have anything to be ashamed of.
I know. But we don't exactly feel like proving that by doing it on TV. You don't suppose the Matrix is bluffing?
Cooper took a deep drag on the cigarette. It's possible, but it's difficult to be sure. I don't think it's the sort of thing that steel would do. And the Matrix is steel. On the other hand, we're faced with a unique situation. The Matrix is desperate to establish contact with what I suppose it considers its other self, to complete its own identity somehow. Precisely what that means, I don't know, but it is driven. And you know Steele, he's relentless. The word quit is not in his vocabulary.
Why doesn't the Matrix just tell him itself then?
It tried to, Cooper replied. Only it apparently came as quite a shock to Steele. Imagine how you'd feel if you suddenly got a phone call from yourself. It seems he ripped out the phone out of the wall. The Matrix wasn't aware that we hadn't told him about its existence. Rather than upset him any further, it chose to contact me. And then you, to prevail upon us to explain it all to him.
And you were on your way over there to do that?
Yes.
Without checking with me.
I already knew how you felt about it.
Higgins gave a small snort over the phone. You must be fully recovered. You're back to your old, insubordinate self.
You were wrong, Higgins, both you and Jennifer. And your judgment was, for obvious reasons, less than clear under the circumstances.
I won't dispute the point. What do you think he'll do?
I have no idea, but I suppose we'll find out, won't we?
You think Casey should be in on this?
Asked Higgins. I think that should be Steele's decision.
Okay. What do you want me to do?
At the moment, nothing. You might as well go back to sleep. You'll probably have a busy morning.
Sleep? You must be kidding.
Cooper cleared his throat. It's none of my business, but is Jennifer with you?
Yes.
Then I suggest you give some thought to what the two of you are going to say to Steele in the morning. I'm not really qualified to give Steele a full explanation. I imagine he's going to have a lot of questions.
I'll bet he will,
said Higgins.
The trouble is, I'm not sure we have any answers for him.
Have you arrived at any answers for yourself? Asked Dev.
What do you mean?
I mean, have you given any thought to what you're going to do about the Matrix?
We've been discussing certain possibilities.
Well, before you discuss them any further, I think you should consider a few things, Cooper said. Such as the fact that the Matrix could be monitoring our conversation even as we speak.
This is a secure line.
I don't think that makes any difference, Dev said. I know you have my line tapped. Well, the Matrix had no difficulty whatsoever in bypassing or rerouting that tap somehow. Your agents, wherever they're set up, I assume they're somewhere in the building, found themselves listening to a private conversation between two other parties. And when one of them came up to investigate and Kurt Samuels took the phone from me, the Matrix wasn't there any longer and he found himself listening to the same conversation. Or at least to one end of it. God knows what he thought. It was a rather intimately detailed conversation between two young women. It seemed the versatility of the Matrix is considerable.
Well, we already knew that,
said Higgins uneasily.
But I guess we didn't know how considerable.
It told me that it was capable of accessing just about anything it wanted to within the electronic net, said Cooper. That it made and stored backup copies of itself in dozens of different places, and that it was capable of interfacing with them in an instant. That it was one program you wouldn't be able to wipe.
Backup copies,
Higgins said.
That hadn't occurred to me.
Think about it, Cooper said. Think about the implications. About what the Matrix has become. It is a sentient, human personality with human frailties and human feelings. Without a body, loose in the electronic network. But in another sense, the electronic net is its body. The entire communications apparatus of this country, such as it is like the Matrix nervous system. That makes it very big, Higgins. And it makes it very powerful. There was a long silence on the line. It does tend to give one pause, doesn't it? Said Dev softly. There was no response. I'd take some time to think about it, Dev said. I'll see you in the morning. End of chapter.